Well, welcome everybody. It's very special to have that honour here, to hear about Yindjimara in this place. Stan, how do you feel being here outside?
I feel at home. Is this on? You can hear me? Yeah. I feel at home, and I just want to say thank you to Mum Matilda and my brother Paul. And I know our brother Joe isn't here tonight, but he's here. So I want to pay my respects to my family who are here with me, even though they may not be here tonight. This is the most beautiful book event I could ever imagine. Now, you do a lot of these events when you release a book and you go around the country, and they're often in those big halls and there are hundreds of people. But to be here under this tree, behind the cross, under the stars, to feel the earth, this is where I come from, the earth, and to be here and to be able to speak these words in this place, there's no more special place to be.
Stan, we're discussing your book today, The Queen is Dead.
Yeah.
Which came out last week. And it's not been an easy week for you,
no.
Has it? And it's not entirely been a week in which you've lived in this kind of space.
No. I mean, we had the coronation last week, of course, and the ABC had its coverage of the coronation. I was invited on there to talk about, obviously, the book coming out, but to talk about the coronation. And as Brother Paul said, to speak truth, to speak the truth with love, to speak the truth with Yindjimara. Because we don't wield the truth like a sword. We offer the truth with open hands. We speak the truth as it's handed to our ancestors, but it is the truth. But to speak truth to a country that doesn't want to hear it, that is not ready for it, that can't receive the truth with love, is always going to spark a backlash. It says more about them than it does about me. If I hear that, and this has been a week that I don't go onto social media, or I try to leave a lot of that stuff out, but people come and tell me, and the horrible, horrible racial abuse, the threats, the viciousness, the attacks on my family. I look at that, though, and I feel sorry. I feel sorry that they can walk on our land with such hatred in their hearts. That after all that they've taken from us, it has not given them peace. And when I hear that abuse, and I hear the things that people say, I just offer more Yindjimara. I offer more love, and I pray that they will have the peace that my people have in this country. That nothing that has been done to us in our own land has ever taken who we are. So I hear that, and I offer back love. I offer back Yindjimara. I offer back forgiveness, and I offer back truth. Truth with love, even if they're not ready to receive it with love.
And that's not at all an easy thing, Stan. I remember that when the Queen did die, I think I was with you that day or the day after, There was a incredibly noticeable change in you. Your first reaction to the news was, as you write in this book, an all-consuming rage. A rage that took you over, would you say?
I was surprised by it. But it was a moment. The Queen's death was a moment. She was the only Queen most of us had ever known. I was raised as a boy standing in the quadrangle at assembly, having to recite the oath at school. I honour my God, I serve my Queen, I salute the flag. The Queen loomed over our lives. But I also know what the crown represented to our people. In the name of the crown, our land was stolen. In the name of the crown, martial law was declared on my people, Wiradjuri people, in the Bathurst War. Martial law that said we, as Wiradjuri people, were placed outside the protection of the law, that we could be killed with no repercussions for those who killed us, that there was, in the words of the Sydney Gazette reporting on the war, there was an exterminating war. That's the phrase they used. In the name of the crown, our children were taken away. In the name of the Crown, our people were locked up. In the name of the Crown, we were separated and segregated on reserves and missions where we were expected to die out. When the Queen died, it was like all the wounds of history reopened. And I was confronted by my own anger, my own sense of resentment. I looked around at Australia mourning the death of the Queen, and I wondered how they could mourn the death of someone who upheld a crown that had brought so much damage to our people, and yet have any love for us. And I suppose in that moment I was confronted by that, and the only thing I can do in those moments is to write. Writing is where I find myself. Writing is where God and my ancestors are waiting for me. And so over an 8-week period, I wrote this book, and I didn't want to write about the Queen as an individual. As a person, I had Yindjamara, love and respect for the individual. I'd met her. But I did want to confront what the symbolism of the crown represented. The symbolism of whiteness and what that represented. The symbolism of colonization and empire. And I wanted to explain what it is to stare into the abyss of history, to carry the wounds of history on our souls and on our bodies. And I wanted to ask myself, how do I speak back to history without becoming a prisoner of history? Where do I find love in the face of hate and horror? And the entire book, and you were there as part of the journey of that book, Jack, the entire book was working through that in myself so that I could speak back to something in my nation.
And you weren't speaking alone. The voices of your ancestors did come and sing with you.
Yeah.
A beautiful and moving part of this book is when you rediscover the poetry of your mother, writing about the welfare men.
Yeah.
And the poetry of your uncle Kevin. You know, using poetry and writing to speak back from devastation to history. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Our people are storytellers. When you heard Brother Paul tonight, what a magnificent storyteller. Around this fire to talk our words, a language that was almost silenced. Our language was almost silenced. And here, under this night sky, around this fire, we heard those words 200 plus years later, still being spoken, so that you can be brought into this space and be surrounded with love and warmth and respect. That's our gift. Our gift is in our stories. My mother used to, as a Gamilaroi woman, she used to spend her time at night after we'd gone to sleep just writing poems about the welfare men when the welfare men came to town and took the children away, how they took her younger brothers and sisters away, talking about poverty, talking about family and love and survival. And I often wondered about that because, you know, we lived a dirt poor life. I was born into an Aboriginal family, a homeless family, an itinerant family. Dad moved us from town to town looking for work. He did manual labor. He worked in sawmills. He lost the tips of three of his fingers trying to put food on the table. I went with Mum when she knocked on the doors of the charities and the churches, begging for food relief, swallowing her pride and humbling herself so that we may get a food voucher to be able to make up for what Dad could not provide for us with his own hands. And yet finding time at night to sit there and write so that we may remember. I found a little book written by my mum's brother, my Uncle Kevin, who's passed away now, who wrote of his memories of childhood in the most beautiful, poetic way, and wrote of the night when the police came to the little tin humpy that they lived in on the outskirts of town, where his little brother was buried who died young, and how the police put a gun to his father, my grandfather's head, and how the bulldozer rolled over the tin humpy that they lived in. And I was always struck by this description. He focused storytelling is focusing on the little things to tell the big things. And he focused on this little bit of wire. And he said he could see the wire that attached the tin humpy to the tree, straining and straining. And as he describes it, he says, it was like the wire was our family. And our family was hanging on. And then it all just fell to the ground. It all just fell to the ground. The poetry in the souls of these people, the love that they bring to those words so that we may remember. And what I wrote in this book was a gift that came from them and an honour to the poets in the souls of my people that allow me to find the words to speak back and speak truth to this country today.
You know, this rings out the hollowness of that phrase we have heard a lot this week, Stan, which is that it's all in the past.
Yeah.
This is history. I think that the poetry of your mother, of your family, of your people shows that this is living within you. And I was hoping that you might read to us an extract. I think you know the one that I'm thinking too, about the graveyards.
Let me see if
history,
I can see that.
Or whichever one comes to you.
Did you mark out the... It's this one? I'll just grab my glasses. Not much light here.
No worries.
This might give you some idea of how I tried to find the poetry in the words. That's not the one.
One of these marked ones. Every sentence in this book is worth underlining, so that's, I think, why the issue is.
Let me see. Is this it, Jack? No.
No.
Where are the? It was my mother's section, I think.
I think it's the green.
It's the green?
This one.
I do want to find this now. See, we're around a fire. It's nice. We can take our time. We don't have to rush.
Miragerie time.
No, that's not it. That's not it. No? The ghosts? The cemetery? Was that it?
That's it.
No? I'm trying to find it.
Or anything that strikes you, doesn't
it? I want to... Oh, okay. Oh, yeah. This is good. Okay. Ghosts are very important. Birriks, eh? We love birriks. We love ghosts. My mother told me ghost stories. She lived in a world where there was no living, no dead. The dead spoke to Mum, appeared to Mum. She told me about the little man in the wheelchair she saw disappear before her eyes. And then weeks later, she saw him again, lifted out of the back of a car by two old women in black dresses. She swears no one else saw him but her. She told me about a white man on a white horse who would sweep up behind her as she walked back across the open paddocks in darkness. A white man on a white horse. It's biblical, isn't it? Torn from the pages of Revelation. And I looked, and behold a pale horse, and his name that sat on him was Death, and Hell followed with him. I don't know if Mum ever read Revelations that closely, but she knew Death. She knew that these stories, these ghost stories, would warn us. They would frighten us. The spirits marked the borders beyond which we could not pass. If we dared, a red-eyed, vicious, snarling dog would devour us. We were told ghost stories to warn us that someone was always watching us. And the ghosts Mum saw were white. They were always white. Of course, we are haunted. It makes so much sense to me now. She was haunted, Mum. She was a haunted girl in a land haunted. It is haunted by what is lost. A deep ache that comes from the depths of the earth. Sit by a river at night and feel the rustle of wind and the hooting of owls and the stirring of animals. And know that there is something else out there too. Not malevolent, but mournful. At dawn, stand alone and watch the mists lift from the earth as it slowly warms under the rising sun. Watch how that mist fans out and spreads across an open field like souls returning to rest. On crisp, cool mornings, whenever I am back home, back on my land, I like to walk to the graveyard at the top of the hill and sit and feel the sunlight touching my face to open my ears to the sounds around me. There's a dog barking in the distance, and I see smoke from morning fires, reminding me that there is life down there, and it is stirring now. All around me are headstones marking time and mortality. It reminds me just how random is this life and death. There's an old chipped marker leaning into the earth. The names and dates are faded, worn away by wet winters and dry bone summers. Here, a child has lain in rest for over 100 years. The child was loved and mourned once, but no one is left to mourn now. No one comes. No one lays flowers or writes the crooked gravestone. This is the fate of all of us, to be forgotten and then haunt the earth.
Stan, you live in a world of ghosts.
Yeah.
Your people live in a world of ghosts. Yours is a dreaming culture in which the dead and the living intermingle. And I think that's why the weight of those words can be felt so heavily in this circle here. The rest of Australia is not living in a dreaming world.
No.
The rest of Australia imagines the world through the eyes of the Enlightenment, through the eyes of reason, through the eyes of liberal democracy. You're a thinker, you're an observer, a commentator on global affairs, a keen student of intellectual history, theology, philosophy. We spend most of our time discussing these ideas. How do you live within the contradiction between that world of ghosts and this Enlightenment world outside of it?
Because I know that the world of ghosts is more real. That's the truth. The modern world is a disenchanted world. It's a world that has stripped the spirit, the soul from the world. It's an untethered world. It's a world that apparently has given us so much. We can reach the moon. We have more computer power in our mobile phones than NASA used to put Neil Armstrong on the moon. We live longer than we've ever lived in human history, apparently. And yet there is a deep ache. There is an alienation. There is a sense of being untethered in the world. The modern world, as we understand it, was born out of an idea that we could kill God, that we could bring God to earth and tame God, and that human beings could be gods. There's a phrase by the Enlightenment thinker Immanuel Kant, which really captures the essence of modernity. And he chose his words very carefully. Dare to know. Dare to know. Dare. Do we dare know? Can we know the secrets of the universe? Can the world be reduced to what we can see under a microscope? Are we gods? When in that phrase, dare to know, I think we can hear the burners of Auschwitz lighting up. I think we can see the gulags. I think we can see the colonization and empire, the divine right of kings to claim other people's countries, genocide. Dare to know, as if we are above all. it's something as a Wiradjuri person that's impossible for me, because I know that there are things I cannot know and I don't need to know. Like love. Can we put love under a microscope? Can we tell what it is in this tree beside us tonight that so entrances us, enchants us? I can reduce that tree to its chemical components. That can't tell me what I feel when I look at that tree. The disenchanted world of modernity cannot speak to the world that I live in, a world where my ancestors are not gone. They are here. A world where God lives in a tree, in the earth, in the love of the people here tonight, in the words in this book, in my mother's words and my father's deep wounds. That world is more real to me in the realest sense, real beyond what we can know. We know so much. What we also know is that we have the capacity to destroy life on the planet, that we have ruined our rivers and our oceans, felled our trees, poisoned our land. In the name of progress, we keep reaching for more, and we know there are so many people in our world with less. Sometimes it's better to live in the world that we don't know than the world that we do know.
And the difficult thing about this for you, Stan, and I mean you, is that you live in the world of the media, you live in the world of politics as well. On a Monday night, you go and do Q&A, and then on the Tuesday, you're out of there, you're reading books, we're in conversation, you're on country, you're thinking about deeper things. In the year of the voice referendum, when there is so much pressure on your people and on yourself, an expectation to engage in the language and vernacular of politics, how do you survive in that?
In the voice, in what Brother Paul did tonight? Think about it as a voice. As a voice. As a voice to listen to. As a voice that speaks to you. As Paul said, as a voice that comes out of the earth, the words of this land. This can't be captured in a constitution. As Paul said, it's a gift. It's a gift to a constitution. I find myself in those words. I find myself in that truth, in the voice. A voice beyond whether people will vote yes or no. A voice that is refused to be silent, a voice that is still here today. That's a voice that's more real to me. It's a hard year. It's a hard year to be a First Nations person. There's division in our own communities. There's division in the Australian community. There's so much hatred and viciousness. I feel judged. So many of our people feel judged. That it's not just a referendum on a voice in a constitution. It's a vote on us, a judgment on us. The racial abuse that we have seen this year, football players copping it every single week, players being booed again, not because of how they play the game, but because of who they are. The racial abuse that I receive every single day in the worst of social media. The vicious racial abuse. The people who would rather tear us apart. The death threats. The threats to my children. The horrible racial abuse of my parents. We walk through this every day. It is incredibly hard. And hard for me as someone who straddles these worlds, because I do host Q&A. I am in the media, and sometimes I feel as if I'm complicit, as if it is so hard to separate myself from that world and this world. And I know that this is the world I want to be in. This is the world that is real, a tree and a fire and people and stories. And the world of the media feels like an empty, alienated place, a place that it can be so toxic. So it's very hard personally. But if I can sit by a fire, if I can hold Mum Matilda's hand, hear the words of Paul tonight, sit by this tree, read, write, read poetry, sit with the words of God in our own country. That's what sustains me.
And I've seen this firsthand, Stan, because we're traveling all the time around Australia and having conversations, and I see how you hold what is precious and close to you, dear. You know, we've been reading James Joyce this week, haven't we? And you pulled out this quote earlier in the week from Ulysses. This is James Joyce, an Irishman, having his characters engage in the context of English oppression over Ireland. And it goes, "But it's no use," says he, "force, hatred, history, all that. That's not life for men and women, insult and hatred. And everybody knows that it's the very opposite that is really life. What?" says Alf. "Love," says Bloom. "I mean the opposite of hatred."
Yeah.
Love.
I love James Joyce. James Joyce is someone who reached for the universal in us, but not a universal that's defined by whiteness. Not a universal that's imposed. Not a universal that comes from empire. Not a universal that puts reason and science above everything. But a universal that connects us to each other's souls. There's a beautiful quote by Paul Ricoeur, the French philosopher. And he says that the shortest distance to the self is through the other. The shortest distance to the self is through the other. We don't know ourselves until we meet someone else. That's how we find who we are. And that's where we find God. That's where we find our ancestors. I there's a period in the book, and I do hope you buy the book and read it, but the front half of the book grapples with history and the weight of history. Grapples with my own anger, my own confusion at the emotions that I felt when the Queen died, of what happened to my family, of the wounds on the bodies and the souls of my family. And then about halfway through the book, it takes a turn where I reach for love in a chapter called Love, where I reach to my people, my ancestors, and it takes me on a journey back to a river, sitting there surrounded by my people, my ancestors, hearing our language spoken and feeling close to Baiame, God, our creator. And I want to just read a little bit from the beginning of the chapter on love. It involves a journey. I was driving to Canberra from Sydney to give the Don Aitken Memorial Lecture. And I wanted to write about history and how we can break the chains of history. Each part of the book begins with the same sentence. The White Queen is dead. The White Queen, because I wanted to differentiate it from Queen Elizabeth. I wanted it to capture the idea of whiteness and the crown and what that means to us. The White Queen is dead. It is dark outside, still, silent, and dark. There is the hum of the road. Headlights illuminate the edges, throwing just enough light for me to see where I am going. But I am transfixed by what lies just beyond the light, the hills and the trees, the empty fields, just as it always was. How I love driving at night when I can lose myself. Alone, I can feel the earth, and I know what is out there. Endlessness. Not time invented, but time permanent. Time that does not run in a straight line. In my car, in the darkness, there is life out there, all around me. We don't see it in the daylight. At night, I can hear the murmur of old songs, of voices, of footfall, of eternity. I see a boy in the back of a car, huddled in with his brothers and sisters. It is me when I was young. It is night. It is always night. I look outside at the white fence posts as we pass by. This is the safest place in the world for me. Inside that car, nothing can touch us. The rest of the world is out there, and in here there is us, a little family with no home except the one we have made together. For hours I watch my mother and father in the front seat, silence mostly, the quiet broken by a soft word here or there. Dad sings to himself and keeps time by holding a bottle top and running it across the grooves of the steering wheel. He hands a packet of cigarettes to my mother. She takes one out and lights it, the red tinge piercing the darkness and shrouding her face as she takes a drag and passes it over. These are moments of love, soft intimacies. Sometimes she reaches across and gently strokes the back of his neck. This was the rhythm of my early life. My childhood was a blur of small towns. Each of my siblings was born in a different one. We were never in one place long enough to call anywhere home. Today we might say this is homelessness, but back then it was just life. It was all we knew. We bedded down in cars or by the side of the road. We lived in tiny gypsy caravans, sometimes sawmill shacks. There was never a place to plant a garden or pin a poster to a wall. Friends from that time are today mostly just a blur of faces, sometimes only a name. I was rarely in one place long enough for many names to stick. My heart aches for that little boy. He is always with me. I am always there in those little towns. I feel sometimes as though I could close my eyes, open them, and be back there, as if time has stood still. I can hear my grandfather coughing as he always did. His lungs were damaged when he was a boy, and he was always gasping for breath or heaving up phlegm. I can see my mother making porridge. I can see myself toasting bread stuck on a long fork over an open fire. Dad has gone to the mill, and my brothers are curled up next to each other in bed. The stone floor feels cold, but there is warmth in the love in that little shack. I have been around the world and back, and yet a part of me, maybe it is the truest and best part of me, has never left that time and place. Love. Just this evening, only weeks after the White Queen's death, I was talking about love, about hope. Hope and love in a world where those things can seem like false promises. But what else is there? Why else am I here? I was talking about love. I was hoping that the people in the room could find it in their hearts to love us too.
You showed me the other day, Stan, a photo of you as a little boy. I think it would have been around when you're at school in the Three Ways Mission.
Yeah.
And you're sitting there amongst your classmates. You are the only Aboriginal boy in the photo.
Yeah.
And there's a sadness in that little boy's eyes, a sadness that is in the eyes of many of your people, a sadness in the eyes of your great-grandfather too, a photo you showed me of him the other day as well. The love you just spoke of and wrote of so beautifully is not joy, is it? It's a sad love song. It's a lament.
It is a lament. I love the word lament, and I think if the book is anything, it's a lament. You know, we live in our world today, and we hear a lot about healing, and we hear about reconciliation, and we even hear about justice. Could there be any healing big enough for the hurt in our people? Is reconciliation even a big enough word to hold all of our history? What justice could give us back what we have lost? But there is lament. Lament is sitting in the sadness. There is grace in lament. We just had Anzac Day, and what is Anzac Day if it's not a lament? Lest we forget. We remember those things, and that matters. On that day in Anzac Day, I remember my grandfather and my great uncle who died on the fields of France, and I share with my fellow Australians a lament for loss. And yet when we speak of our truth, how often did Australians find it so easy to turn away, or tell us to get over it, or to talk about reconciliation. But we need time to lament, to just sit with the unutterable sadness of it all, and in that sadness find love and God, and in its own way, grace. And if healing comes from lament, then that's a wonderful thing. But sometimes it's enough to just sit and say, lest we forget.
One of your favourite philosophers, the French mystic Simone Weil, says that love is not a consolation, it is a light. A light on our wounds. And I know, Stan, from speaking with you, travelling with you as you were writing this book, this was a spiritual journey for you.
Yeah.
Your relationship with your creator, with Bayami, with God, you're sitting beneath the cross now, is really the foundation of this love which you give so generously to the rest of us, myself included, as an undeserved gift of Yinjimara. What is the place of the sacred in that sadness for you?
When I was a boy, and other black fellows here tonight will remember this, you know, the churches that we went to, the Aboriginal churches, sometimes we were just sitting around a fire and passing a guitar around. We'd always sing the old rugged cross. You know, on a hill far away stood an old rugged cross, an emblem of suffering and shame. They were the churches of the forsaken. It wasn't a place where we asked, is God real? We knew God was real. But it was a place where we asked, why, God? Why do these things happen to us? We were the forsaken. That's the reason I wanted to have this tonight, under a cross, by a fire, by a tree, because on the cross, Jesus says, my God, why have you forsaken me? That cry rings true for us. And yet we find love. You don't know love is real until love is absent. It's in the absence of love that we look for love. You don't know God's real until God's not there. You don't know what it is to suffer until you have suffered. Simone Weil, who you mentioned, and I quote in the book, said that God leaves the world and evil often fills the space. God leaves the world because we are in the world. We can't exist. If God could come down and fix everything tomorrow, we'd still find things to mess up. But even when we're forsaken, she said, God leaves love. And it's that love that allows us to find each other and to find our way back to a fire and a tree and a cross and God. That's what I learned as a boy. That's what I carry with me. And that's what led me to a river to sit at night and put away the horrible things of history and to find something else to give me hope.
I remember one of the most transformative moments for me this year was when you took me to the Warren Gersdon Mission along with a few others at Darlington Point. And the Warren Gersdon Mission is a sacred place for the Wiradjuri people, for your people. You took me to a river outside of the mission stand, the Murrumbidgee. And you said, Jack, I want you to jump in the river and I want you to surrender to it. I want you to feel everything you know slip away from you. And I felt that as my feet were mired in the black clay. I felt the Australia I knew slip away, but I also felt sadness for you, a friend, torn between worlds, unable to live in that space all the time. What would your message be to the rest of us here as a Wiradjuri person who lives with a broken heart and a state of lament? How can non-Wiradjuri people, non-First Nations people come to love with the Yinjimara to respect and honour that sadness?
I think you're feeling it tonight, aren't you? You're sitting here. You're sitting around that fire. We're talking about stories. Has anyone talked about politics, the budget, democracy? Those things are important. They're the things we have to do. But they're not the things of eternity. Our fires have been burning for tens of thousands of years. We've sat like this around fires and we've told stories for tens of thousands of years. And that's what we'll keep doing. That's all I want to do. I don't like politics. I like poetry. There's a beautiful line written by the Scottish poet and politician that hangs over the Scottish Parliament. And it says, Andrew Fraser wrote it. It says, if I could write all the songs, I would not care who wrote the laws. Our laws were a song of our people, the song lines of our people, our ancestry. That has never gone. You can write laws, you can hoist flags, you can write a constitution, you can carve out borders, but a story is what makes a nation. A story. We've been fortunate tonight to share a story. The Queen is Dead is a gift of love to history so that we may share a story. A story will make this country, Australia, whatever we call it, it'll make it real. But it can't be a story that doesn't begin with us, but it doesn't end with us. It's a story that accepts you too, if you want to accept what Paul tonight called the gift of our voice, the gift of Yindjimara, the gift of love that we keep giving even when people have no love for us. We know when something's coming to an end, the fire starts to go down. I know people are getting a bit cold tonight. I want to just say thank you to everyone for coming out here and sharing in this story. This has been the most beautiful book event I have ever been a part of. If I could do nothing else but sit around fires and tell stories and share love with people from wherever you have come on our land so that we can feel as if we are one people, there is nothing else I'd rather do in my life. Mandungur, thank you.
In the words of your father, Wiradjuri language, Mandungur from me to you, Stan. And thank you everyone to be here in Braving the Cold. I feel regenerated, I feel anchored in the sacred now, ready to face politics again. But this is a sacred space and thank you for being here with us. Thank you, Stan. So,
thank you.
The book is going to be sold in that little building over there now, Paper Chain Bookstore from Monica, have very helpfully turned up. There are bathrooms there, light refreshments. Stan's going to hang around for probably the next 20 minutes or so, half an hour. So if you want to have a quick chat and get him to sign the book, I'm sure he'd be happy to. But thank you so much for being here again today, Charles Sturt. So honoured to have you here in this beautiful space. Thanks, everyone.